We're pleased to welcome Mr. Mickey Edwards here today on campus. Mr. Edwards is Vice President of the Aspen Institute and serves as Director of the Institute's Rodale Fellowships in Public Leadership. He was a member of Congress from Oklahoma for 15 years, after which he taught at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government for over a decade. At Harvard, he was the first John Quincy Adams Lecturer in Legislative Practice. He was also a lecturer at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. Mr. Edwards is one of the founding members of the Heritage Foundation, an influential conservative research organization based in Washington, D.C. Early in his career, Mr. Edwards was a newspaper reporter and editor, working in advertising and public relations, and served as a magazine editor. He is the author or co-author of four books, including his latest book entitled The Parties Versus the People, published by Yale University Press. He has been a regular political commentator on National Public Radio's All Things Considered, a weekly political columnist for the Chicago Tribune and Los Angeles Times, and a regular contributor to a number of other major news outlets. Mr. Edwards is a frequent public speaker and has been a guest on many of the nation's leading radio and television news and opinion broadcasts. He received a BA in journalism from the University of Oklahoma and a JD from Oklahoma City University School of Law. Would you please join me in giving a warm welcome to Mr. Mickey Edwards?
Hi. Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here. It's great to be at a great university like this that places so much emphasis on values. I've been a great fan of BYU's for a lot of years. And I'm delighted, you know, Jennifer, who is going to be up after me, you know, from Oklahoma State University, which is one of the minor colleges in Oklahoma, you know, from Broken Arrow, you know, I feel like I'm at home again. Although I have to say, when I was leaving, I'm at the Aspen Institute in Washington, D.C., and when I was leaving yesterday, I had my suit bag. I don't wear this all the time. I was in my jeans, but I had my suit bag with me, and so one of the people I work with at the Aspen Institute saw that I was leaving again to go give a talk, and he said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "I'm going to Quarterback University," and he instantly knew that it was BYU. So... And so, you know, it's a delight. You know, I'm older than most of you here, and so I've had a chance to, you know, watch Jim McMahon and Steve Young and Gifford and Detmer and you know, so it's great. And also because I taught at Harvard and lived in Massachusetts while I was up there, became a big fan of Danny Ainge, you know, and the Celtics. I'm sorry, you know. Those jazz fans, but you know, but anyway, I'm delighted to be here. I do want to say now, being a politician as I am, you know, sometimes you talk about things that are none of your business, and so I'll say this: none of my business. I watched the game against UVA the other day. I watch a lot of BYU games, and I don't know if you all know this, but the Big 12 Conference, which is actually a lot better than the Southeastern Conference, the Big 12 Conference only has 10 teams in the Big 12, and I really sincerely hope that BYU becomes the next one. So, you know, that'd be great. I appreciate the opportunity to come here and talk about some of my thoughts about where we are as a country, about the great strengths that have made us what we are, and some of the challenges that we face, and quite serious challenges if we are to remain the kind of a special country that the founders bequeathed to us. I've always been struck by the famous quote from Benjamin Franklin when he was confronted outside of Convention Hall after the Constitutional Convention was ended and was asked, "Mr. Franklin, what have you given us?" And he said, "A republic, if you can keep it." And that's what I want to talk about, because my concern is whether or not we can keep it. So last week, we celebrated Constitution Day, and so by agreement, this is now still Constitution Week. We have we've lengthened it now to Constitution Week. And, you know, like all of you, I love the 4th of July. I love the celebrations, the 4th of July, and what it stood for, and all of the aspirations that the Declaration put forth, and the fact that that laid the groundwork for us to become what we are today. But it was not the Declaration of Independence that created the America that we live in. It was the Constitution. It is the Constitution that is what we are, who we are, why we are the way we are. And you see so many people making their predictions that maybe soon some other country, some China or India or somebody else, is going to replace us at the center of the international stage. But the fact is that the United States today and for a long time to come is and is going to be the dominant political, cultural, military, and economic power on this planet. There's no question in my mind that we are the nation at the top of the hill. Whether or not we are still that shining city at the top of the hill is not quite so certain. And that's what I want to talk about. So the American Constitution is still a very young document, as we're still a very young country. There are people in Congress. There are people on this campus. There are perhaps people in this room who have been alive one out of every 3 days. There has been a United States. That's how new we are. The system of government that we created is still an experiment. And we don't know yet whether or not it's going to survive. The question is not whether our system of government will survive all of these great threats that a nation like ours invariably faces, whether it's Al-Qaeda or ISIS or whatever other threats or economic threats. The question is whether our system will survive us. Will it survive us? And this is not going to be a cheerleading talk. I want to lay some challenges out before us. I want to look at the question about whether the greatest threat, not to our security, but to our American constitutional government, is from the outside or from us here on the inside. So let me start by acknowledging that there is such a thing as American exceptionalism. I know that bothers some people. We are different. We are exceptional. But we're not taller or stronger or wiser. We're not exempt from the rules that govern other countries or the laws of countries. We're exceptional not because of the strength of our armies or because of our economy, but because we're a different kind of a nation. We're a nation that was set up to honor the dignity, the rights of every single individual human being. We live in a community, and here at BYU and in Utah, I'm a great representative of this, it's a community. It's a community of shared responsibilities and shared obligations and people often acting collectively and sacrificing for each other. But we've also created a system of government that lays out in pretty stark relief that the American, you, me, the American is not a subject of government, but a citizen. And there's a big difference. Because governments tell their subjects what to do, and citizens tell their governments what to do. So we created this system that here nobody was going to be sent off to war without the approval of the people through their representatives, or taxed more than we agree to through our representatives, or regulated to a point that kills our creativity. Our founders, just more than 200 years ago, created a unique system of self-government in which we ourselves select those who are going to make our laws, and we hold them accountable. How does that work? How is it supposed to work? It's supposed to work by us delegating authority to legislators whose appointment we decide, and by prohibiting the concentration of power in the hands of any single individual or any small group of individuals, and by placing every single major power of government, whether or not to go to war, what to tax, how much to tax it, how long to tax it, what to spend it on, what programs to create, what programs to end, what policies to create, whether treaties will be approved, the power to appoint judges and generals, including the Supreme Court, even the power to name the members of the president's cabinet. Not to the president, but to the people's representatives in Congress. If you walk down the street in Provo, or in Salt Lake, or in Oklahoma City, where I'm from, and stopped somebody on the street and said, who's the head of government in the United States? 9 out of 10 would say it's Barack Obama, and earlier, 9 out of 10 would have said it's George W. Bush. That's not true. We don't have a head of government in the United States. We have 3 separate, equal, independent branches of government. But all of the major powers, all of the major powers are in Congress, because the Congress is the representative of the American people. So I want to look at a few of the things that our Constitution does and does not do. And I want to get into the challenges that we face in this regard. Our Constitution establishes both authority for government action and restrictions on government action. We are surrounded by people who all think that either the government should have no power or the government has all power. We have a system of government that gives power to the government and restricts that power. Despite the claims of some, we are not 1,000 independent communities. We are a great nation. Our Constitution empowers government. It gives it authority to act in our behalf for the general welfare and for our collective defense, and it also constrains government. The Constitution does not, this will shock some people, the Constitution does not guarantee small government. When you have a nation of 312 million people with obligations for the common defense and for nationwide communication systems, highways, national system of roads, even if it did nothing else than those things, it cannot remain small. But it does mandate limited government. It sets some things outside the boundaries of permissible government action, and that is the system that set free the creative energies of the people, that established us, Americans, as the champions of enterprise and as a model to the world of rule by law, as a nation apart, exceptional. And yet, with every single day that passes, we see a greater and greater impatience with these special attributes of our constitutional exceptionalism. Among those people who are most committed to activist government, there is impatience with a system that is designed to force deliberation rather than speed. I had this conversation, I was talking to somebody right after the Affordable Care Act was enacted, and I don't really care in any of these things I say. I don't care whether you were for it. I don't care whether you think the Affordable Care Act was the greatest thing that was ever done or the worst. That's beside the point. Right after the Affordable Care Act was enacted, I was talking to somebody who said that it was terrible. It took Congress a full year to pass that legislation. Our government made fundamental, far-reaching changes to a system that affects every single American, and people were complaining that it took so long. Now, sometimes the bureaucratic decision-making is terribly slow, but when it comes to making laws and setting priorities and policies, our convoluted, multi-part system is deliberately designed not to speed things up, but to slow things down, to require time for information to be known, tested, dissected, debated, so those things that will affect all of us so greatly will not be subject to the passions of the moment. A system that acts deliberately rather than rashly is one of the fundamental strengths of our constitutional framework. It is not a system that should be sped up to suit our impatient age. You know, there's so many things that start to happen that you observe that make you wonder if people understand what this system is supposed to be. So one of my fears for the future came when a former Speaker of the House, I won't name him, maybe later, but when a former Speaker of the House attacked a president of the other party for being secular. And, you know, one has to wonder where that speaker was when the First Amendment was being discussed in his government classes. We are a religious people for the most part, but we live under a constitutional form of government that honors all religions and that adheres to none. And because we are a nation that honors diversity, we have at least some hope of holding certitude at bay. But I will come back to that because increasingly today, it is certitude, a closed-mindedness and reluctance to hear other views, a conviction that we know and anybody who disagrees with us does not know, that makes us so vulnerable to the changes that threaten to undermine our constitutional democracy. My greatest concern, well, I said it's one of two. My greatest concern, because too few voices are raised in fear about it, is the accumulation of power in the hands of the chief executive. So again, I'm going to name people from both parties. I don't care. I just like them both equally. During the presidency of George W. Bush, remember, I'm a Republican. During the presidency of George W. Bush, when there were unprecedented claims of executive authority, widespread use of signing statements by which a president said that he could declare for himself whether or not he was bound by the laws that Congress had passed and that he signed, and claims of executive privilege that extended not just to the president and his immediate advisors, but to the entire White House staff in all of their interactions with each other, whether the president was even involved or not. A redefining of the unitary executive doctrine that would defy congressional attempts to instruct the federal agencies about the law. Expanded claims of the right to keep secret government actions. A cavalier disregard of the constitutional prohibition against suspension of habeas corpus rights. All of those claims and more undercut the pretense that Americans were still entitled to practice self-government through the empowered legislative branch selected by the people. But this is not a one-party, one-person problem. When the Bush administration sanctioned torture and extraordinary rendition and holding prisoners indefinitely without charge, many people warned that if that sort of thing is not checked, those actions would establish a precedent for other presidents as well. And on fundamental constitutional questions, habeas corpus, secrecy, government surveillance of American citizens, we were too late. Presidents changed. The policies didn't. The disregard for the Constitution and the fundamental rights of the American people continued. For too many who are concerned more with an immediate outcome than with preserving the underlying principle of the American system of government, the checks and balances. The language of the Constitution, for so many of these people, has become just a thing of mild interest. Nothing more than that. At the same time, we've seen a further erosion of the Congress as the principal arm of American constitutional government, largely as a result of two fundamental overlapping and mutually reinforcing problems. First, the Congress's abdication of its responsibilities and obligations under the Constitution. Not authority that was taken from the Congress, but that the Congress let slip away. Acquiescing, for example, to this. Presidents send the people to share intelligence. Remember, the Congress is supposed to decide about war and about treaties and about things that are important to our national security. And the executive branch under this president, the last president, the president before that, the executive branch sends some people down to the Hill to meet with members of the Intelligence Committee, not all of them, can't be with all of them, with the Gang of Eight, eight members of Congress, says we're going to share this information with information that is held by thousands and thousands of government employees, and we're going to share it with you, eight members of Congress, and you cannot tell any of your other members of Congress, and you cannot tell any of your staff. And the Congress puts up with that. Instead of saying, Mr. President, we'll tell you how the Congress is going to operate and who we're going to share information with and what we have to do to get the information that we need in order to act as the Constitution requires us to act. The Congress often writes blank checks to the presidency, even on matters as fundamental as going to war. And at the same time, along with that, we move more and more toward a European style of parliamentary government. Was there one thing, if I had to pick one thing, that distinguished America from what had gone before? It was the rejection, the repudiation of the parliamentary system. Some of you who have studied, public policy or political science are familiar with Edmund Burke, the British parliamentarian, who famously in his speech to the electors of Bristol said that, I owe it to you not to just be a rubber stamp for your views, but to use my own judgment, to be a trustee for you, for the country, to use my judgment, my experience, my knowledge, to act in the nation's behalf. Nobody ever talks about how he started that speech. I'm making this up because I wasn't there. But my guess is he started that speech by saying, "Hi, Bristol, my name is Ed." Because under the British system, you did not need to be from the place you were supposedly representing. And our founders said, no, you're not going to be representing a party. You're going to be representing the people who elected you from their constituency. But we are moving more and more to a system in which Democrats in Congress feel obligated to support a Democrat if he is president, and Republicans in Congress feel obligated to support a Republican if he is president, not members of a separate branch of government to be kept in check as the Constitution envisions, but as the captain of your team, as the leader of your Republican or Democratic team, to whom partisanship demands unquestioning loyalty. That was true when a Republican Congress went along with George W. Bush. It's true when a Democratic Congress goes along with Barack Obama. But it's not just these things about security and surveillance and habeas and rendition. Last month, President Obama announced that he was going to bypass the Senate in consideration of a climate change treaty, by pushing instead for a, quote, non-binding treaty that would nevertheless have the United States pressuring countries to meet various emissions reductions targets or face reprisal. Now, you may have thought that a climate treaty that curbed emissions was the most important thing we could do, and you might think it's not. The question is, who decides that? And what happened when the president said to the Senate of the United States, I'm just going to go around you? The Senate majority leader didn't open his mouth, not a peep, not to defend the Congress, the Senate, the process, the democratic principles. If the president wanted to go around Congress because the majority leader liked the outcome that he was proposing, that's what they would do. So policy matters in a democracy, obviously. The policies that we have matter. But in a democracy, process matters. Not just what our policies are, but how we make them, who makes them, what the process is that we decide as a country what we're going to do and what we are not going to do. Today, almost regardless of the issue, Supreme Court nominations, tax policies, health care legislation, almost anything, Republicans are all on one side and Democrats all on the other side. It's amazing, really. I mean, it's really almost a miracle that you see Democrats in Congress, whether they're young or old, urban or rural, regardless of their experience or their education or their constituency, vote alike. It's amazing what brings about. Republicans do exactly the same thing. Wherever they're from, you know, whatever their backgrounds, whatever their experience, Republicans stick with Republicans. And that's because our current election system, I'm going to get personal here in a minute, because our current election system puts too much power in the hands of the most partisan, who in most states control access to the general election ballot. And because they do, too many members of Congress no longer weigh seriously the views of all their constituents. They look over their shoulders in fear of the activists and the ideologues who can end their careers if they are not sufficiently intransigent and uncompromising. There are exceptions, there are rare instances in which bipartisanship makes a brief return to the national stage. But for the most part, our politics today is Team A against Team B all the time on all things. The first four American presidents disagreed on a lot of things. They didn't even like each other all that much. But Washington, Adams, Jefferson, and Madison all agreed on one thing. Don't create political parties. They wrote about it. They spoke about it. They had political parties, but they were different. They agreed on a few things, maybe tariffs, maybe whether they were pro-British or pro-French, but they were not together on everything all the time. They had nothing like the political parties that we have created here today. Driven by this never-ending war between rival political clubs, always in a search for partisan advantage. Increasingly today, in both houses of Congress, the party in the majority, whoever it is, Democrats one time, Republicans another, the party in the majority blocks consideration of alternatives, blocks amendments, blocks other proposals. There is more actual, serious debate in a social studies classroom in Provo High School than on the floor of either the United States House or Senate. Well, there are many ways in which we fail to follow the vision that was laid out by our founders. This is going to be a little bit of an aside. It's one of my own pet examples. America was founded in large part to ensure justice. U.S. attorneys throughout this country don't call themselves U.S. attorneys. What are they call themselves prosecutors. They're focused more on prosecution than on justice. And like Inspector Javert in Les Miserables, judge their worth by the numbers of people they put behind bars, even if that means hiding evidence, as was the case when they went after Senator Ted Stevens in Alaska and destroyed his reputation and his career, only later to have been found out that they had hidden information. This happens all over as our overzealous law enforcement puts our rule of law claims to shame. Well, we have another. This is maybe more of a policy question. Even though pursuing justice is a major priority of ours, think about it if you're poor and you're unable to afford an expensive lawyer and you have court-appointed attorneys who in many cases are overworked and unable and unskilled in whatever it is that you are accused of. And so you're denied meaningful access to the justice system. So my point here is only that we're a nation that has a great aspirational value, and we have so many challenges that we fail to meet. But I want to end with 2 points. We have this wonderful Constitution, and the first thing is that we decide who will make the laws that govern us. And I'm not going to dwell on how our campaigns are financed, because there's certainly a lot of reason to be concerned about that when a wealthy few have disproportionate power. But something else. We are a democracy. We're a republic in form of government, but we're also a democracy in choosing how people are going to make those laws, who those people are going to be. A democracy. Not in my state of Oklahoma. Not in your state of Utah. Not in most of America. When Barack Obama became president and Joe Biden became vice president, we needed to have an election in Delaware to decide who would be the new senator from Delaware. And Mike Castle, former congressman, I mean the current congressman and former governor, was very popular and was expected to win that seat. They had a primary election in which only his fellow Republicans could vote. And he lost to a political newcomer named Christine O'Donnell. And so people said, well, why don't you just run in the general election? And you would easily win in the general election, but he couldn't. He couldn't. Because in Delaware, there's a law. It's a sore loser law. And under the sore loser law, if you ran for your party's nomination and you didn't get it, your name is not even allowed to be on the ballot. The party activists are able to keep you off the ballot, are able to deny access to the ballot. And here's the thing. She got 30,000 votes in a state of 1 million people. And the 1 million people were not able to vote on who they wanted to be in the Senate because he was denied the opportunity to be on the ballot because of 30,000 activists, because of the sore loser law. And that was a Democratic example. Here in Utah, your senator, and here again, I don't care whether you were for Mike Lee or Robert Bennett or Bridgewater, I don't care who you were for. None of my business. Your senator, Robert Bennett, was denied his party's nomination at a convention that was attended by fewer than 3,500 people in a state of 3 million. So whether you would have preferred Bennett or Lee or anybody else is none of my business, but there is something undemocratic when a convention attended by 0.1% of the state's population is able to keep the incumbent senator off the ballot to see whether or not that's who the people of Utah might or might not have wanted representing them. Sore loser laws allow small groups of party activists and ideologues to even consider who should go to Washington to represent them. And that is the case. I could go into it. I'm not going to. We could go into Texas or Massachusetts. That sore loser law that allows small groups, in this case 0.1% of the population, to keep people off the ballot is the law in 46 states. Our Constitution envisions people choosing members of Congress who must be an actual inhabitant of the state from which they are elected, so that you know your constituents and they know you, and you can be their voice and you know their interests. And today we allow whatever party controls the state legislature temporarily to draw district lines that tells people who can vote in this election and who cannot. So when I was in Congress, I was the ranking member of the Subcommittee on Foreign Operations, and one of our jobs was to decide who gets foreign aid, what countries get foreign aid. That was a decision we based on a lot of different factors. One of them was how democratic. So look, if some nation, when I was there, if some nation had been proposed as a recipient of foreign aid, in which small bands of loyalists could block access to the ballot and they could shape the electorate to determine who could vote, to let the insiders choose the voters who would be allowed to participate in the election, there is no way we would have approved foreign aid to that country. That country is the United States today. So my latest book, as you've heard, was called The Parties Versus the People. It has a subtitle. I didn't write the subtitle. The subtitle is How to Turn Republicans and Democrats into Americans. And it's not a matter of them not being Americans. They're loyal, patriotic, good people who care about the country. But they sit down together as a party to work out ways to burn down the other party, like Sherman marching through Georgia. If you all in this room, with your love for BYU, decided that you were going to build a new building, God knows you got enough buildings, right? What a magnificent university this is. But if you got together and you said, we're going to build a new building here, what would you do? You'd all gather together. You'd say, where should it be? What should be in it? How big should it be? What resources? Not one of you, not one person in this whole place would say, okay, Republicans sit over there, Democrats sit over there, and let's come up with rival plans and fight it out. We don't do that in anything in our lives except the way we run our government. So let me just conclude by saying this. James Madison and the rest of the founders gave us a blessing. A government in which the people would be citizens, not subjects, and hold ultimate power. And that is disappearing, and I want to leave a challenge here to you all. We have created a public that doesn't understand the Constitution, that doesn't understand civics. Most of our universities, I will assume for the moment that BYU is a different case. Most of our universities don't teach civics, they don't teach critical thinking, they don't adequately fund the humanities. Most of our universities and schools have become vo-tech schools. I went to a vo-tech school, it's called law school. Teaching you how to make a living and how to be successful in being a part of the economic machine to compete with China. And two schools focus on the humanities, the things that make you a citizen. Not just an earner, but a citizen. Art, music, poetry, literature, philosophy. We cannot save this constitutional republic of ours unless we create at the same time a people committed to this form of government and willing to stand up to save it. The founders created it. Saving it is up to us. Thank you.